Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to talk in the course of this hour with a most extraordinary man who has devoted much of his professional life, which is a lot, and a very distinguished one at that, to try to protect the country we love against a threat that, until very recently, I think most Americans couldn't imagine could befall us, let alone devastate us. The form of warfare that I'm speaking of is biological warfare. And one of our country's preeminent experts on the subject, in fact, I think probably one of the world's great authorities on the matter, is Dr. Stephen Hatfill, MD, and a bunch of other things as well. And we're going to talk with him about some of his extraordinary credentials, as well as his life of devotion to protecting, as I say, the American people against viruses and other forms of biological warfare that we've had a taste of in the course of the past 2 years. And we're going to talk about an important study to which Dr. Hatfill contributed mightily, entitled "The CCP is at War with America," a Team B report on the COVID-19 biological warfare attack. It has a marvelous foreword by our friend Gordon Chang and is really required reading if you're concerned at all about what took place in the course of this COVID pandemic and what is flowing from it. Dr. Stephen Hatfill is a member of that Team B study, as I said, and an extraordinary colleague and valued friend, and I'm delighted to have him here to talk about our experiences to date, the report, his concerns going forward, and what we must do now to protect ourselves against those threats. Dr. Stephen Hatfill, welcome back to Securing America, sir. I am so pleased to have you with us, and thank you for giving us a full hour of your time. This is a great honor indeed, and I look forward to our conversation.
It's nice to see you, Frank.
I want to start by just getting your credentials out, if I could, Steve. Give us a bit of your background, both in terms of your various degrees and, you know, your life experiences.
Well, I became interested very early on. I dropped out of college for a year and went to Africa and worked in a remote bush hospital. And decided tropical medicine was my interest. If you're going to study tropical medicine, it's nice to go over where the diseases are. So I went to Rhodesia. I think 1977. I'd gotten out of the army, and I got tropical medicine all right. And the medical school, I think there were only 40 in my class. It was a there were more professors there than students, and it was a sister college of the University of Edinburgh. So the Edinburgh professors would come over and do our examinations, and it's quite a wonderful education. When I got out, I did some courses in, I went to South Africa and did my internship, rotating internship, surgery, pediatrics, OBGYN, and general medicine. Very surgically oriented, like we used to train our doctors back in the World War II era, where you can handle most common surgical emergencies. A lot of trauma training. Went down to Antarctica as the team physician for 14 months. Came back and did a master's degree in molecular biology, virology, where I worked on a insect polio virus called aphid lethal paralysis virus. and sort of fell in love with virology. Went on to do another master's degree in medical biochemistry. And then I started a third master's degree in experimental pathology, working on leukemia and radiation-induced leukemia, at which point the professor came over and hunted me down and said, did I want to specialize in this? And I said, yes. So I completed a residency in hematology. At the same time, South Africa had a biosafety level 4 laboratory run by former lecturer of mine, Robert Swanepoel, and we made arrangements to start working there. I was going to work on gonococcal hemorrhagic fever. And about 3 months before I was due to start there, there was a wage and price freeze by the government. So Dr. Swanepoel kindly introduced me to Dr. C.J. Peters at USAMRID, United States Army Medical Research Institute for Infectious Diseases. We tried to make something work back then, but it didn't quite do it. I went on continuing some of my leukemia studies, specifically the first to describe the use of thalidomide in acute myeloid leukemia, pre-leukemia, which is a sister drug, is now the mainstay treatment for 5q deletion myelodysplastic syndrome. Came back to the United States and did a fellowship at the National Institutes of Health on advanced tissue culture methods at NASA NIH Center for Three-Dimensional Histoculture. And this work led me to Fort Detrick, where we developed a tissue model to determine why didn't anyone die from Ebola during the Reston outbreak. It turns out this is a non-pathogenic strain, yet it killed monkeys. Humans were exposed to it, but they only developed antibodies. There was no clinical disease. And we found that the endothelial cells, the cells that line the blood vessels, were very susceptible.
Dr. Hepfel, let me just interject here for 1 second. Again, Fort Detrick is the Army's center for biological warfare defense, and your clinical background and experience there has obviously equipped you very, very importantly to both diagnose various diseases, infectious diseases, and to help fashion regimes for trying to counter them or protect people against them. Finish up this extraordinarily rich history, if you could, quickly, because I do want to get into some of the application of all that experience, if I can, too.
My interest as a doctor was mass casualties and how are we going to handle this. The BWIRP, the Biological Weapons Improved Response Plan, had come out under General Donna Barbish, who was a prime driver of this getting done, National Guard. And I got involved with those folks. And then later on, the terrorist threat of the use of these weapons, I became involved in creating the hospital portion and teaching the hospital portion of how we handle a biological attack. That went on. I was training members of the military as a defense contractor to negate this. I trained as a UN weapons inspector in France.
Dr. Hadfield, I have to ask you to break. We're just going to take a quick pause. We'll be right back with more with Dr. Stephen Hadfield right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. President Biden is reportedly so frustrated that Senator Joe Manchin has stymied his so-called climate change agenda that he is prepared to declare a state of emergency to implement it without congressional action.
Exactly what that would mean is unclear. Presumably, sweeping measures will be mandated because President Biden insists, quote, this science is settled, unquote, and greenhouse gas emissions must be curbed. Expect mandates for further reductions in the use of fossil fuels. The Securities and Exchange Commission is already proposing to penalize publicly traded companies for failing to get with the Green New Deal program. But wait, two of America's most eminent scientists rebutted the SEC, declaring, quote, there is no climate-related risk caused by fossil fuels and carbon dioxide, unquote, and that the adoption of the commission's proposed rule would cause, quote, disastrous consequences for people worldwide, unquote. Say no to Joe. This is Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are continuing a conversation that we will engage in for this full hour with one of the most knowledgeable men on the planet about biological warfare and, well, the danger of the American people being catastrophically subjected to it. You've heard just a portion, frankly, of Dr. Stephen Hatfield's life experiences and credentials to address this really vitally important topic. Especially in the context of this new analysis of the Chinese Communist Party being at war with us and using biological warfare techniques against our country. Dr. Hatfield, I know I'm going to cut short this very, very impressive resume, but I did want to bring it to the present moment if I can.
Yeah.
All of that background made you obviously a go-to guy when the COVID virus known as SARS-CoV-2 emerged from China. Talk about what happened with you and your willingness to lend a hand at the White House, and then what went sideways.
I 2014, the West African Ebola outbreak, I watched the U.S. response very carefully, and it was abysmal. I started researching what really were our pandemic plans, and we had national pandemic plans as early as 2005, first time in our country's history. And these had been amplified by Health and Human Services. So I wrote a detailed book. It took several years to research, and it was published in November 2019, 3 seconds until midnight, describing the problems, what was broken, what needed to be fixed. The December of 2019, the China announced their first case of COVID-19. So there was a big rush. The book had come out. And I suddenly found myself brought into the White House. A number of factions had developed. There was the Dr. Fauci faction, who didn't seem to know what he was doing. And I was put in with Peter Navarro into the Office of Trade and Manufacturing Policy because, lo and behold, under Obama, we had let all our drugs, virtually 80% of our drugs, be manufactured in China and India. Right now, Frank, we don't even make penicillin in this country. These were just the beginning of the problems. What drugs did we need for COVID-19? So we started working on that. And the data started coming in about a drug called chloroquine, which the South Koreans were using. The Chinese, we found out, were making metric tons of this stuff. And then South Korea sort of came around to a safer drug called hydroxychloroquine. And the French studies, Dieter Raoult, Professor Raoult, was showing remarkable findings. If we gave this early, within the first sort of 5 to 7 days of symptom onset of COVID-19, you got sick, but you didn't go to hospital, by and large.
Right.
Even patients that had severe comorbidities, chronic obstructive airway disease, heart disease, diabetes, overweight, this type of thing, were staying out of hospital This work was being used in the United States by a very, well, he passed away recently, but a very good general practitioner in New York. And the data looked, I mean, it was overwhelming. You don't see this benefit from many drugs like we were seeing with hydroxychloroquine.
And this data and your findings obviously informed Donald Trump's decision to express his enthusiasm for hydroxychloroquine and its use in this early treatment fashion, for which he took unbelievable amounts of grief and ultimately had to back away from it, no?
You know, we were very fortunate that Dr. Robert Kadlec had a position as Assistant Secretary for Health and Human Services. And Bob's an old Iraqi weapons inspector. He goes back years of experience in this field, and he had been sold on the use of hydroxychloroquine. So Pete Navarro was able to get us about 62 million doses of this drug within days.
Wow.
I didn't ask him how he did it. But we had this, and we put it in the national stockpile. Congress had given an organization called BARDA the authority to handle all this type of stuff and the monies that were being dumped into this. And I was working with a gentleman called Rick Bright, who was the director of BARDA at the time, and some others, trying to get this country back onto a plan of early outpatient treatment. And we were being fought every step of the way by Dr. Fauci, who, for reasons known only to himself, was focused on an experimental drug called remdesivir, which at the time had only treated one patient, the first case that appeared in Seattle on American soil. There were cases before that, but this was the first recognized case. And you cannot stop a pandemic by treating patients in hospital.
Right.
Hopefully you can reduce the death rate, but you cannot control an epidemic.
Let me just make sure I understand the timeline here, Dr. Hatfield. There was Fauci's preoccupation with remdesivir before he became so fixated on these mRNA vaccines, as they're called. This was a sort of early run at trying to push his agenda on the rest of the government, right?
Yeah. And I initially supported remdesivir. I was an outside advisor. I came in every day at like early. I never saw the sunlight for a year, really.
Wow.
But it was our department that got the chemists in and figured out how to make it. We didn't even know how to make it. It was made in China. And they were taking the patent from it and just going to make it anyway. They don't care who owns it. And then we got a first report of their clinical trial, and it was abysmal. I mean, this drug was killing patients. And it was clear to see from this study. And I thought, well, that's the end. Chris dropped it on my desk, and I looked at it, and he was all worried. And I said, well, that takes care of that. This will never be used. And lo and behold, it suddenly became Dr. Fauci's choice you couldn't give it outpatient. It had to be given IV. It was about $5,000 a course.
And it was not only to be used, it was mandated, as I recall, was it not?
Yeah.
As the response if you were hospitalized with COVID.
Yeah. So we had two things going on. We had Fauci and his damn remdesivir, and we had the hydroxychloroquine. All we needed to use the hydroxychloroquine that Peter had put in the national stockpile on a single piece of paper. Some of our friends gave us this drug, and they didn't want to be used for other things like lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, this type of thing, and that's understandable. they donated this much drug, and they don't want it sold on the open market.
Sure.
It was a gift.
Yeah.
So all we needed was an investigational new drug authority, single piece of paper.
But let me just clarify something, if I may. Doctor, you say an experimental new drug. This was actually a drug that had been used for years, if not decades, had it not, for other purposes, to be sure.
Yeah.
But you're talking about a new application of the drug for this purpose. And it was deemed to be extremely safe.
So safe, pregnant women could take it.
Yeah.
Nursing mothers could take it with no danger to the infants. I mean, you just don't have drugs like this.
Right.
Very well understood. And we had the CDC itself had done some studies in 2005 elucidating the mechanisms for the former SARS-1 virus.
Dr. Hatfield, hold the thought. This is a story that we're going to develop further. We'll be right back with more with Dr. Stephen Hatfield.
In cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Dr. Stephen Hatfield is with us. We are talking about his experiences in the White House. We're talking about some of the forces that were at work trying to prevent the early use of a well-known, safe drug known as hydroxychloroquine for, to be sure, a new application, namely treating COVID, a disease heretofore unknown, but that the people surrounding the president at that time, including in this so-called health task force under the vice president, and under the influence of both Dr. Tony Fauci and Dr. Deborah Birx, vehemently fought. So pick up the story there, sir, if you would. As the data showed, remdesivir was not only not therapeutic, but downright murderously dangerous. And hydroxychloroquine was safe and highly effective. Getting that piece of paper that you talked about should have been a no-brainer, I assume. Who did it have to come from, and why didn't you get it?
It had to, well, what happened, Rick Bright and Dr. Kadlec did not get along, to say, that's putting it mildly. They hated each other. And
Rick Bright was who?
Fight, this was the director of BARDA. Not a physician. Dr. Kadlec's a physician. In fact, he was flight surgeon for the 24th STS, which is a Tier 1 special operations unit. Brilliant history. Weapons inspector. I can't say enough good about him. And he knew, and we had meetings in the office, and this was going to go. And we were just fortunate. And Peter somehow, Navarro, got the distribution organized within about 4 or 5 phone calls. I mean, I couldn't believe it, what was happening. All we needed was
a formidable man.
Oh, my gosh. And The next morning, Janet Woodcock, who was head of drug safety development at the FDA, phoned him. And I'd had meetings with her before, sitting in on meetings. There was always something a little odd there. You pass it off. I'm the new guy. But she phoned Rick Bryan and said, look, what you need is an emergency use authorization, because this is a very dangerous drug, and it needs to be given by people that are in hospital so we can keep an eye on it, because it causes irregular heartbeats and death. Well, 300,000 patient review had just appeared, done by Oxford University, showing no major cardiac events, no nothing. This is a really safe drug. We're going to use it early in the disease. We're going to use it for 5 days only. It's going to cost $11. You'll get sick. You'll develop a long-term natural immunity, and most of you will stay out of hospital. 80% of you will stay out of hospital.
Sounds like a God-given alternative to what we were subjected to.
It was.
Yeah.
My projections were no more than 36,000 deaths total.
Wow.
So you need to understand COVID-19 is a two-part disease. There's the first part, upper respiratory tract infection. Then it goes down to your lungs and really severely damages your lungs and triggers septic shock. If we can keep this disease and treat it while it's still in the upper airway, it doesn't. When your stove's on fire, you don't wait for the fire department to arrive. You throw water on it. Shut off the electricity, throw water on it or foam or whatever, and you extinguish the fire early. This is what we do with all infections. This is what we do with cancer. This is common sense.
So the Woodcock intervention kept that piece of paper from being made available, I take it, and therefore kept hydroxychloroquine out the solution?
Because they kind of threw the regulation. I don't care. Use it as an investigational new drug anyway. We're at war. Seriously, right. The country's at war. We're scared to death. The early models, the Ferguson model, which proved to be totally inaccurate, was projecting 2 million dead within months, which would have collapsed the infrastructure of the New York City mega region and the LA mega region.
This is, of course, Neil Ferguson, a professor over in the UK, who came up with this cockamamie model.
And he's a raging idiot. He's never been right in his life. So it was quickly proven.
But it scared everybody to death.
It scared me. Yeah. It scared everybody. We've not seen anything like this. And then this myth about asymptomatic transmission. If you're not showing signs and coughing and blowing your nose, Frank, how do I get my virus from me to you? You know, what was happening, they were running the detection tests at too high an amplification cycle. I mean, you were getting to...
This is a very complicated business, but the short form of it is, as I understand it, if you test it at a high enough amplification cycle, you can find evidence of a problem of any kind, basically. Is that fair?
Water will give a positive result, saline, if you amplify. They were using CT values of 40. You know, about below 20, 24, 25, you might be infected, but you're not really transmitting it to anyone. You know?
Yeah.
So at 40, you were picking, everybody was turning positive.
Right.
That didn't mean they were infectious.
Or necessarily even had the disease, right?
Yeah. Their own innate immune system was handling it.
Right.
Because some of the cold viruses are coronaviruses, and you were getting cross immunity.
Yeah.
With the SARS-CoV-2 virus.
This is such an important point.
Lots of science.
Yeah. It's kind of a perfect storm of bad data, bad models, misconducted tests, and bad policy, you know, prescriptions out of the FDA.
Remdesivir is an antiviral drug. It only works if the virus is rapidly replicating in your body, and it's one of the subunits of its genetic blueprints, remdesivir, goes in there and it stalls replication of the virus. Frank, after 5 to 7 days, there's no more virus replicating in your body.
Right.
You know, it's now due to the second part of the disease, which is your own immune system damaging everything. So you're going to give this to a late stage patient and it doesn't work. You're not doing anything. Yeah. You got
except,
it now.
Except
now.
Killing them because it attacks your kidneys, yeah. As I understand it, right? So, doctor, we're going to run out of time before we run out of anecdotes on this. Let me just cut to the chase if I can. You're at the White House. You're watching this train wreck taking place. You've got an alternative. Peter Navarro's got a lot of the drug on hand. You said they just were going to start giving it out anyway. But that didn't happen.
Under doctor's prescription.
Yeah, so just, of course.
You're not going in and get it over the counter. You're going to go see your family doctor, right, like you do with a cold. He's going to make a clinical judgment. You don't wait for tests.
Yes.
You come see me with a cold. I don't send it off for 120 different viruses that can cause these symptoms. I make a guess. We're in a pandemic. You got the signs of it. You got a temperature. Right. Here's the drug. Go home. Don't kiss anybody. Use a separate toilet. Don't go to work. Stay hydrated.
And if you phone take it early, this is going to take care of you. Minimize the conditions and keep you from getting worse. Yeah.
Once you get that shortness of breath, you're in bad trouble. You started circling the drain.
And you get to that if you haven't been treated early and you're essentially then hospitalized and intubated and all the rest of it. So, doctor, just pick up the thread here. How did we go from having lots of hydroxychloroquine and having, you know, the authority basically to start using it for this kind of early treatment to a point where it became essentially prohibited? Even discussing it was a subject of cancellation.
Doctors were prescribing it off-label, which you're allowed to do as a physician. There's a lot of drugs we use off-label.
Right.
And they were having undeniable results.
Successful
Fauci would
results.
Not listen to anything.
Successful results.
Hydroxychloroquine.
Yeah.
Absolutely. They were keeping communities. We're starting to get it under control. The peak that was heading up in New York City actually started to plateau a little bit after a couple days of this. Doctors were prescribing it readily, a safe drug. It was all working well. And Fauci wouldn't acknowledge it. Of course, clinical studies were done. And the people that do the clinical studies, they're on hospitalized patients that are already in the second phase of the disease. So you're not going to see it does any good. Then the president said, well, you know, I think this hydroxychloroquine got something here. And that's when all of the press started their nonsense.
The press and Fauci and others. Doctor, hold the thought. We're going to take just another quick break. We're going to come back and we're going to hear the rest of that particular story. And what we've learned since about the nature of this disease, its origins, and what it suggests is the purpose of the Chinese Communist Party to do much more damage to us than was done in the case of COVID, bad as that was. Dr. Stephen Hatfill is making a house call virtually. We're delighted to have him with us, one of the country's preeminent authorities on this whole biological warfare issue, and we're grateful to have the chance to visit with him, and we'll continue momentarily. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. President Biden is reportedly so frustrated that Senator Joe Manchin has stymied his so-called climate change agenda that he is prepared to declare a state of emergency to implement it without congressional action.
Exactly what that would mean is unclear. Presumably, sweeping measures will be mandated because President Biden insists, quote, this science is settled, unquote, and greenhouse gas emissions must be curbed. Expect mandates for further reductions in the use of fossil fuels. The Securities and Exchange Commission is already proposing to penalize publicly traded companies for failing to get with the Green New Deal program. But wait, two of America's most eminent scientists rebutted the SEC, declaring, quote, there is no climate-related risk caused by fossil fuels and carbon dioxide, unquote, and that the adoption of the commission's proposed rule would cause, quote, disastrous consequences for people worldwide, unquote. Say no to Joe. This is Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are continuing this conversation with one of the most interesting and, I think, accomplished medical doctors in the world in the space of treating and otherwise countering biological warfare, which we now have reason to believe is exactly what we have been subjected to as a result of this COVID-19 pandemic, as it's known. Dr. Hatfield, we've spent more time than we probably should have setting this key piece of the story up, but give us what, from your firsthand observations inside the White House at the time, went so seriously sideways when President Trump thought there was, in fact, real hope that the COVID pandemic could be contained or greatly diminished, at least, by hydroxychloroquine, and instead we now have a million Americans dead and the costs almost unimaginably high in terms of both our economy, of course, our society, and our republic, our freedoms.
Yeah. A variety of, because the majority of early study clinical studies were being done, funded by Fauci and the NIH, these were being done on hospitalized patients. There were no early use treatment, outpatient studies, community-based medicine. It was all in-hospital patients. And nothing was working. Remdesivir wasn't working. Nothing was working. Nothing was going to work. These people are circling the drain. They're septic shock. And we're making it worse by intubating and ventilating them. And then remdesivir, given at a time when there's no live virus left in the body, essentially, shelling out their kidneys. So, and then Neil Cavuto screaming on Fox Business News, don't take chloroquine, it will kill you. A very bad Brazilian study was done where they gave lethal doses of chloroquine, twice lethal doses, to patients that were already dying of HIV, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, heart disease. They were already dying. They were going to die anyway. And this is what's cited. And then Woodcock comes in, puts a black label warning on hydroxychloroquine. Of course, now it's just for early use COVID. It's not for in-hospital use COVID. It's not for rheumatoid arthritis. We're giving this less doses than some rheumatoid arthritis patients are taking. We're only giving it for 5 days total. No, it just applied to that. And then the doctors got scared and quit using it. And then this fraud papers appeared in the Lancet, 96,000 patients showing hydroxychloroquine. The data was all made up and published by Richard Horton, well-known connections with China. And we're sitting back here aghast. Where did this virus come from? I refuse to believe that it had a natural origin for really over a year. I was fighting my colleagues that thought, you know, they were saying, oh, Wuhan lab, Wuhan, that's where it broke out. this had to be. And I said, gentlemen, this we don't have enough data. We this has always been a natural outbreak. The MERS virus, coronavirus, the SARS-1 virus, civet cats, wet markets.
Preceding diseases out of China.
And yeah, everybody's looking at me like I'm from Mars. Well, how can you say that? I said, because the data isn't there. And then in 2021, we started getting the data. And we were convinced we were going to find what animal was the intermediary. You can't just jump from an animal to man. There's usually an intermediate animal where the virus learns how to, you know? So this never turned out. And if you take and make two columns, what's the evidence for this being a natural outbreak? The answer is zero. They didn't find it in any of the wet market animals that were there. They didn't even find antibodies, much less they found virus in the environment, but these are sick people coming in coughing and spewing. What's the evidence that it had a laboratory origin? And this is a trifecta of circumstantial evidence, but when we're looking at the genetics of this thing a lot closer, there's no way this could have been natural. You hear a lot about the furin cleavage site. That wasn't the deciding factor. Other coronaviruses have a furin cleavage site, and I won't get into the details what it is. It's a short little thing of amino acids in a protein that's part of the virus. And it helps the virus get into the cell easy. Upstream of that is the sequence for a functional motif, a folded protein that is equivocable to staphylococcal enterotoxin B, which is a known biological warfare agent. It's the active part of that. We call it a superantigen. And this appears to be what's causing this cytokine storm and spiraling into the grain.
And that would not have naturally wound up in the genetic amino acid chain.
Occurring randomly mutations. Well, by this time, you've mutated this part again. This had to have been inserted.
And so what you found, Doctor, is that something that is a very dangerous biological agent was deliberately inserted, evidently in the Wuhan Institute of Virology's Level 4 facility associated with the Chinese Communist Party's biological warfare program, to make this coronavirus that does occur in nature into something that could only have come out of such a program. And while we find in this report, we find that, you know, we're basing all this on circumstantial evidence, to be sure, in the absence of the most, you know, clinical proof that we can only get from the Chinese. That's where this leads us, and leads us to a very important conclusion about what the Chinese did with this disease to us. And we're going to find out a bit more about all of that with Dr. Stephen Hatfield on the other side of this very short break. Stay tuned for more about the biological warfare attack on America. We're back for our concluding segment of this extraordinarily important conversation with one of our leading authorities on biological warfare, and a man who has, in the course of a study with our Team B3 of the Center for Security Policy, found some really important evidence that we now believe changes this from a disease that we've been told is naturally occurring and somehow got here into actually a biological warfare attack deliberately mounted by the Chinese Communist Party against our country. So I've kind of stolen your thunder here a little bit, Steve, but make the point, if you would, as to how that conclusion is really inescapable if you just follow the science, as they say.
I don't believe for a second it was an intentional release, but the Chinese were playing with this thing. They had learned the techniques in North Carolina, mutual cooperation between laboratories, and then they went and did their own thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then they went and did their own thing. And this virus just suddenly appeared.
But they did their own thing, if I may just say. They did their own thing with technology and funding from us to do this gain-of-function experimentation, right?
It looks like it. And the animal model to quickly test it, the different combinations on the humanized mice, if you will. That was technology. So you don't just see these things suddenly appear. Better adapted to man than it was to bats or intermediate animals. Man was the preferred host here when it appeared. So it's just gone on from there. China, international health regulations, which China reluctantly signed in 2005, WHO international health regulations. These new regulations were put in 2005 because of this debacle with the SARS-1 virus, where the Chinese hid the fact that they were having severe problems and this had pandemic potential, this SARS-1 virus. So they redid the international health regulations. And China is required within 24 hours of detecting a virus with pandemic potential to notify the WHO. And this did not happen. Some of us think this started back in August of 2019. There's antibody evidence to show it was in Italy by September 2019. They didn't announce until New Year's Eve of 2019 that they had a problem. This thing was already over here by then.
And how did it get over here, Doctor?
They let everybody fly over here, right?
Right. They wouldn't let them travel out of Wuhan into China, but they let them come here.
They stopped inner-city transport. You couldn't get out of Wuhan. The army's there. And yet you allowed at least a million of your citizens to fly all over the world. I've heard reports where families are being offered money, grandma and grandpa, high-risk individuals. Go see your son in America. Here's some money.
Money by the Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, Doctor, what you're saying, if I could just summarize this, then what you're saying is you don't necessarily accept that the Chinese deliberately released the virus out of the lab for this purpose. But once it was out, they took steps both to conceal that it was out, to play down its lethality, and to deliberately facilitate its spread worldwide. Have I got that right?
They didn't try. Yeah, they did not give us accurate numbers for what we were seeing. All those videos were like, I saw one video that was possible because when the guy fell, there was some blood coming out. But you don't fall with outstretched hands. You know what I mean? Suddenly collapse. So not only did they lock down their own population, facilitate the transport of this biological agent overseas through travel, but they used that time to personally buy up the world's personal protective equipment for their own use.
Right.
3M had just built a new factory in China, and they were going to take it over for their own use. I couldn't get powered air purifying respirators for ICU units. They weren't shipping them out.
And again, a supply chain dependency on China that is crazy. Dr. Hatfield, we've got 2 minutes left. What you've described and what we declare in the Team B report is that for all these reasons, this was something deliberately done, at least as a proof of concept of biological warfare by the Chinese Communist Party against this country and others, of course. I want to ask you, in light of all of this and your life experience and the public policy work that you've done most especially, what is the most important takeaway in terms of how we protect this country against the distinct possibility that the Chinese have much worse stuff in their biological warfare kit bag that they may well decide they want to use against us in the future? What can we do to protect our country, the country we love?
It's not just the Chinese. Mother Nature is just as big a threat. There's viruses out there with 60% mortality rate. And our large cities are so interconnected and dependent on goods, services, this and that. You're going to let a city of 12 million people starve because you can't get food trucks?
What do we do? Doctor, we're down to 30 seconds.
Got to be started at the local community level. We need to bring back the old civil defense program with a infectious disease slant and start building from the bottom up with the federal government supplying the things that the local authorities and the training. Rearrange FEMA. They're useless. They're too expensive as they are. And reorient them towards a good portion of them towards pandemic preparedness.
This is where your leadership comes in. Dr. Stephen Hatfield, we have had this hour fly by. Thank you for your work. Thank you for what you tried to do to spare us the worst of this disease. And thank you for your leadership in hopefully sparing us what might be in store for us in the future from China and perhaps Mother Nature. Thanks to the rest of you for joining us for this edition of Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped to help us in doing just that, and that you will now go forth and multiply.